three in one.
Yeah, I guess so. Faculty and administration.
And a graduate.
That's right, alumni. Okay, well, let's start off with just a little bit of background information on you. Could you just state your full name?
Michael Joseph Larson.
And your date and place of birth?
My place, New York City, in January 31st, 1944.
Okay. Well, let's go on to the time that you were a student here. Why did you choose to attend St. Mary's University?
I knew a girl who went to Mount St. Vincent, which is run by the Sisters of Charity, or was then. And I was at a Catholic high school, and found out about St. Mary's through her and through the sisters who taught at the high school, and the priests who taught at the high school where I was attending. I wrote away for some information about the school. It sounded interesting. I was interested in going to a Jesuit university, and the Jesuits were here. And it sounded unusual, to go to Nova Scotia. So I thought it'd be fun to try.
What date did you attend St. Mary's?
I started in 61, and I graduated in 66.
Mm-hmm. What was your academic program?
It was varied. I began in an arts program. I then, after a couple of years, switched to pre-med. Then I switched back and took English and some philosophy. Mm-hmm. And so I had a career, an academic career that was all over the board pretty well.
Yeah. So what then, how did you go on from St. Mary's educationally?
After I graduated, I went to Dalhousie for a master's in English, and then was accepted and completed a PhD at the University of Toronto. Mm-hmm. After that, I went to teach in New York for a while, and while I was here on holiday with my wife, who's from Halifax, one summer I was talking to a friend, or actually my wife was talking to a friend of mine who was the Dean of Arts at the time, George Burpee Hallett, who you've interviewed, and he mentioned to her that there was a sabbatical coming up in the English department and wondered if I'd be interested in filling in for a year. So I filled in for a year for 20-something years now. But that's how I got the job. It was just a complete accident, just happening to be here on a holiday when the sabbatical was approved in the department.
Mm-hmm. So,
and I thought it'd be fun, and it was. It's been great.
At the time that you were a student, did you reside on campus?
Most of the time. St. Mary's, in those days, was probably no more than 600 students. About half of the students enrolled here were resident students, and the rest were what we called day hops. And residence was, it was a real beehive of, this was all the residents, by the way, this wing at the McNally building. And I lived in residence for the first 3 years. And it was all, pretty well young men who, but each floor had a proctor on it who was a Jesuit or a Jesuit in training.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some attempt to control, a real vigorous attempt to control. You've probably heard of Father Hennessy,
mm-hmm.
who was, he came in 1961. And actually came at the end of his career as a social worker in Vancouver. He was about 65, 66 at the time. And he came really and started what became a totally new career for him. He had tremendous energy and enthusiasm. He loved the students here. So he became really a legend. His name was shortened to the hen, and he was actually like a mother hen to everybody. He bailed people out of jail. You name it. If you can imagine, you get 250 guys between the ages of 18 and 22, and he was the sort of dean of students, so it was his ultimate responsibility, and he loved the job. He loved taking care of the students, supporting athletic events. He taught in theology, taught philosophy. He was just everywhere. I don't think he slept for 15 years, you know, because he was so active, and really left a tremendous imprint on the institution, mm-hmm. which, as you can still recognized. Hen Alley, do you know?
Yeah.
Have you seen the portrait of Father Hennessy?
Mm-hmm.
Or in the O'Donnell Hennessy Center, the portraits. Anyway, he had a real impact on certainly a lot of students in my generation, right through until his death in 1980 or 81.
So what were the academic programs like in the years you were a student?
The basic academic programs were arts, science, commerce. We had engineering, very similar to the mix that we have today. Education. There was a graduate program in education, but predominantly it was undergraduate. We also had a degree in journalism in those years, which I think we got out of journalism around 1965. But what was, you know, really unusual or different then as compared to now, it was very much a Jesuit institution that was just beginning to introduce a fair number of lay teachers,
mm-hmm.
and it was all, or virtually all, young men,
yeah.
until there were some women, younger women admitted in the mid-60s to Jocelyn Grasby came, I think, in 1964, and Eileen Carroll, now is her name, she came in around 64, 65. They were both transfer students from the Mount, but they wanted the programs they were particularly interested in. By the way, it's Eileen O'Leary was her maiden name, but they were both interested in particular programs that were offered here and not at the Mount. So they got special permission
mm-hmm.
to attend St. Mary's. Now, Father Hennessy and a lot of the Jesuits were really supporters of making the university co-educational. They thought it might help civilize the guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they were probably right. But they were you might be surprised at that. They were really supporters of it. There was some resistance, I think, at Mount St. Vincent, because they probably worried that they would lose, mm-hmm. A portion of their normal student market to St. Mary's. But it didn't take long before the small number of female students became, well, now it's more than half the population.
So what effect do you think the introduction of women had to the institution?
Well, it's hard to isolate that one change, because it happened at a time when the university was changing in so many other areas as well. The Jesuits formally turned over control to a lay board of governors in 1970. Beginning of tremendous growth in student population occurred around in the early 70s. Those two things combined with the fact that St. Mary's was a co-educational institution, increasingly emphasizing higher and higher academic standards, all those things had a tremendous change in the evolution of the institution. Overall, I would say the impact has been that it's allowed us to pursue a number of things. One, we've been much more concerned with getting female faculty members, for example, and members of staff and administration, as the proportion, the numbers of female students has increased, which has been good. There have been programs that we've pursued that we wouldn't ordinarily have pursued, like women's studies, which have been a benefit to the general student population. So I would, as I say, it's hard to isolate specifically, but it's been part of the maturing and developing process of the university. So,
okay, let's talk a little bit more about the classes that you took when you were here. What type of format were the classes offered?
When I was a student here, believe it or not, attendance was required. Mm-hmm. We had full year courses. There were no half credits or .5 courses. Everything was a full year credit, and attendance almost everywhere was taken by the faculty member. You were allowed to miss no more, if your class met three times a week, you were allowed to miss no more than six classes a term, or you were out automatically. In the early years, the professors, many of them, particularly the few lay professors, wore the academic gowns that were that you see people wearing, students wearing, and faculty members at graduation. Those were a normal part of academic garb, not for the students, but for the teachers. Not all the Jesuits wore them, but they had their own academic garb. Mm-hmm. Classes were, since our classroom size hasn't changed all that much, the classes were very much as they are today in terms of numbers. I was going to mention something about, there was a dress code for the students. To go to class, to go to, or the cafeteria, you had to have a sport jacket and a tie on at all times. So there was the look of the students was a little bit different. There was a big American influence. Many of the students in residence were Americans, and the traditional dress of the American student was white sneakers, white socks, khaki pants, sport jacket, and a thin, ultra thin tie that was tied once at the beginning of your academic career and was never untied during the entire time you were here. But that was the traditional the traditional look. But I don't want to emphasize the fact that there were quite a few Jesuits, but there were also a number of lay teachers, even in the early 60s. Alan Sabian taught chemistry, for example, and Burpee Hallett was here teaching English. Ed Flynn was, although in 1961 he was on sabbatical, but he was also in the English department. I think Arthur Monahan came in 1962. Rolly Smith came in 1962 or 63. Rolly Marshall, rather. Mm-hmm. There were, and the numbers increased dramatically in the latter part of the 60s and the early 70s. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But classes generally were filled, because there was the attendance requirement. It doesn't mean everybody was able to stay awake during all the classes, but they were generally there.
What was the workload like?
I'd love to tell you that in the grand old days we worked day and night, but the workload, it seems to me, was probably very comparable to what it is today. Mm-hmm. Not that the demands weren't perhaps higher, but the Jesuits were an awfully tolerant group, by and large. So it was possible to get away with a fair amount of of the usual student excuses for not getting papers in time and so on. But it was very comparable to today.
Mm-hmm. So describe your fellow students for me. How what were their family backgrounds and ethnic origins?
First person I was introduced to when I came into St. Mary's came up the front doors of McNally Building because there was a big entrance sign and the president of the Students' Council was there to greet, you know, incoming students because there was a load of us coming up from Boston, actually. I flew from New York to Boston. There were a whack of students that got on in Boston and came to Halifax. So they knew when a group was arriving. And so we were there. Actually, we came in by bus from the airport. When I flew over I'd never been into a city airport that was out in the country like that. I was used to city airports like Chicago or New York. I had no idea that I saw all these trees, and I thought, is there a city here? I was really shocked. But I was only 17. I mean, at any rate, so we took the bus in and then a cab from the Hilton up. And when you come up English Street, the side of McNally Building had not been completed. The stone facing had not been put on. So there was just the raw concrete with the steel rods projecting from the side of the building like porcupine quills and the rust coming down. They were a little while before they got the money to finish that side of the building. But it did not make a great impression when you first looked out and saw that side. And then, of course, when you came around to the front, the building was really, it's a lovely building. Mm-hmm. The first, the student council president was from Quebec, a very strong French accent. I remember his name just escapes me at the moment. But he was the first fellow I met. Second fellow I met had a very strong Newfoundland accent. He was from St. John's. The third fellow I met was from Trinidad. Mm-hmm. And I was from New York. I had my own sort of accent. We were like a mini United Nations, all trying to understand and speak a little slower to understand what the residents had quite a mix, a diverse mix of students from. There was a lot from the U.S., particularly from Boston, Manchester area, Maine, and a few from New York, Pennsylvania. But there was a fair contingent from that group. A lot of students from Trinidad, Central and South America, a few Eastern European, but not very many. We even had a student from Montana. So. But so aside from the Canadian students, there was quite a large proportion of international students. I should also mention there were quite a few from Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. So the Asian, Central and South American, the American, it was quite a high proportion. And they were concentrated, by and large, in residence. But the proportion of, how should we say it, visa students was much higher than it is today.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. Were you involved in any school societies or organizations when you were a student here?
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember. That was so many years ago. There was, some of the societies were... the journal, for example, those who wrote for the journal, which I did a little of. There was an art society, which I was a member of. The totally caught me by surprise. Let me think about that. I can't remember the university having, aside from its intramural and junior varsity and varsity program, there weren't as many student societies available on campus as there are now.
What was the role of sports at the university when you were here?
In what way do you mean role? How what sort of profile did it have?
Yeah, that kind of thing.
St. Mary's had a very strong football rivalry with Dalhousie at the time. Dalhousie still had a football team. And the dominant power in football in those years was St. Evag's. Eventually, we, you know, finally knocked off St. Evag's, but the team that we had the most intense, immediate rivalry with was Dalhousie. And in the early 60s, Dalhousie's team, the quality of its play was really declining quite rapidly. But there was an intense amount of student interest in every sport. But it began with football because that was the first season. And I can remember, you know, where the computer center is, McNally East. Well, that at one time had been a chapel. And out beyond that, there was a field, and then there were the playing fields, the football fields. Before the first Dalhousie St. Mary's game, which was here, there was a bonfire set up out there, and sentries were posted around the bonfire so that the Dal students wouldn't come raid it, knock it over before it was able to be, you know, torched and the fire set. And this was an operation right out of World War II. I mean, these were serious sentries who were, you know, looking for collaborators and infiltrators and ready to, you know, smash heads. It was the residence was an incredibly close-knit, intense, enthusiastic group, and its outlet through sports or whatever was really quite traumatic. Mm-hmm. And you could always count on Father Hennessy to, on one hand, try to restrain the fellows, on the other side, I mean, he'd be whipping up. Sometimes he whipped up more enthusiasm than he restrained. He had a kind of a way of just sparking all kinds of school spirit. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, there was a tremendous amount of school spirit, which expressed itself largely in those days through the sports, basketball and football were the big ones, of course. Mm-hmm. But we had great hockey teams, too. Great hockey team. I was going to say soccer because we had a lot of really good soccer players.
Mm-hmm. Being a student in the 60s, were there any types of student rebellion or political action going on at the university at that time?
Anything comparable to Berkeley, the free speech movement, the Students for Democratic Society, the SDS? Nothing like that. Nothing like that degree. I think what happened, like for the American kids, we were in the early 60s attuned to what was happening, certainly like with the Cuban Missile Crisis. When that started to heat up, a lot of us left and, you know, went back, started hitchhiking or whatever, you know, returning because we figured we'd be called up. Then nothing happened. We came back and we, you know, continued on with school. But in the early 60s, where you got some of this was in the journal. Those students like Pat Hickey was a young firebrand from Long Island who, saw the journal and journalism as a way of shaking up the establishment and so on. Mm-hmm. But it was still a fairly conservative. Halifax was very conservative, and the student body, for all the, you know, the youthful rebellion and whatever, was still a fairly conservative group. I mean, it was just wild. It wasn't focused in the same way as, say, the political action groups on campuses were, in particularly in the West Coast of the U.S.
All right. So how has your role as a member of the faculty and administration of the university changed over time? You were hired as a member of the English department?
That's right. In 1971, I was hired on a one-year contract, which was renewed for another year subsequent to that, and then for a third year, at which time the university's size had grown sufficiently that it was beginning to add positions in a variety of departments, and the English department was one area, so that the temporary position I had became permanent. And beginning in that time, as I mentioned before, the university had gone from being a Jesuit institution to a public institution. It began a period of rapid growth. Owen Carrigan was president. He was the first lay president. And as we went through the initial stages of growth and adding new faculty, then we began looking at unionizing. I think we had our first union contract in 1974. Mm-hmm. St. Mary's was sort of in the forefront of we were growing quickly. We, you know, bringing in people from a variety of new areas. There was faculty from there were women faculty and men, and anyway. So, as a product of our rapid growth and a certain amount of tension, I think, in the early years between where the Board of Governors and the university administration saw the university going, and where the faculty saw itself developing, that led, I think, to the growth of fair amount of union activity, and I think we're the first English Canadian university to have a collective agreement. At any rate, so it was a pretty vital and vibrant place where people were sorting out, thinking through issues that are really important. What is the role of the faculty? What's the role of scholarship? The relationship between administration and faculty members, the role of department chairpersons, and so on. A lot of that stuff was being debated, sometimes quite hotly. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty exciting. It was a very interesting time in the mid-70s, right through to the 80s. And at a certain point in the latter 70s, early 80s, our faculty numbers stopped growing, but our student numbers have continued to grow, you know, quite dramatically. So then we entered into a whole new phase of activity where, you know, more and more we have had a variety of part-time people working in the university. Our continuing education programs have expanded enormously. Mm-hmm. We've developed the China Project began. We were teaching at the World Trade and Convention Center, at Burnside Industrial Park, extension centers, more and more remote from the campus began to develop. So there seemed to be an explosion of activity, and new centers of gravity beginning to establish themselves for some people in quite a bewildering way. I mean, this happened within a relatively short period of time. Within a decade, St. Mary's had changed from the, you know, say 61 to 71, there were tremendous changes. 71 to 81, there were again tremendous changes. One, I think, was the the first decade, 61 to 71, is the secularization of the university and the development of a coeducational campus. And then the second decade really was the tremendous outward expansion, the outreach that I think characterized the university. Institutes were set up, collaborative research projects with among faculty members and here and elsewhere. And also, I think during those the third decade from 81 on, I think what one has noticed, particularly at St. Mary's, is the enormous increase in its prestige regionally and provincially, regionally, and even nationally. Mm-hmm. You know, it's gone from when I was a student here for a small undergraduate Jesuit-run institution, which was very good, you know, but a very good. Problem with your eye?
Yeah, something.
Sure.
Okay, so you were saying in the time you were here, it was just a small Jesuit institution.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I said, the total student body was about 600, and now we've got... 8,700 in the fall and the winter sessions, and about 3,200 in the summer sessions. That's another dimension in this last decade. It seems that we've established the tremendous gains, it seems to me, in terms of the national reputation of the university. This is through the faculty. I mean, the quality of the faculty, their teaching and research accomplishments have increasingly been recognized. And so we play in a very different arena. I hope that hasn't, and I don't think it's been to the detriment in any way. In fact, I think it's been to the benefit of the students. But it's meant that we have, in some ways, although the sentiments of the university have remained the same in attempting to provide a kind of specialized and individualized experience to the students, the atmosphere here is really tremendously different from when I was a student. And that would be inevitable anyway, given that I think the population is so different in terms of the age, the distribution. There's not the same international mix, but the age range is quite different now. We have far more mature students or students pursuing part-time programs than certainly was the case when I was a student.
Mm-hmm.
By and large, most of the students when I was a student here were between 18 and 22.
Mm-hmm.
They were virtually all male, and there was very little part-time work, for example, available in Halifax at those in those times. It just didn't exist, and so it was I guess an experience that was not altogether unlike what you might find even today at St. Evex or Acadia, which was basically a residential. And the summer there is rural, but this wasn't all that different because there wasn't the same opportunities for particularly work and other activity outside of pursuing a degree
mm-hmm.
on very traditional timelines. By the way, I mean, even in those years, when I say Halifax was a conservative town, the taverns closed at 11 o'clock. I mean, they had their last call. I mean, there was nothing open on Sundays virtually. It was a very conservative place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite different from how many students do you know who have jobs downtown working in bars or restaurants? A lot.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, those didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And what clubs were really frequented by students were all illegal after hours
yeah.
kinds of things that aren't wouldn't be necessary now.
Mm-hmm. So, what do you think students wish to gain from their educational experience at St. Mary's? Do you think that's changed over the 30 years?
I think it's changed even over the last 10 years, that the students today, the ones that I deal with, have a much higher degree of anxiety about the practicality of all aspects of their education, where it will lead them in terms of the work world, mm-hmm. than was the case even 10 years ago, and certainly was the case when I was a student. I mean, you just didn't worry that much or think that far in the future what this course will contribute to your employability or what this program will be in terms of employability. Partly that may have been naivety, but the fact was, certainly when I was a student, college education was much, you were much more confident in an unthinking way about where it would take you than students are now. So there is a heck of a lot more anxiety, it seems to me, among students today about their programs and as I say, the practicality of it than even just a decade ago.
So what specific academic changes have you seen since the time you were a student as well? In the programs offered, courses offered, things like that?
Well, it's almost too vast to... The program, when I was a student here, the Bachelor of Arts degree consisted of, in terms of numbers of full courses, 22 full courses. It was a four-year program. You took 6 in your first year, 6 in your second, 5 in your third, 5 in your fourth. Of those 22, 15 of them were required courses. To give you an idea, you had to have 4 theology courses, 3 philosophy courses, or vice versa, I can't remember, 2 English courses, 2 full courses in English, 1 math, 1 history, 1, you either had to have Latin or, what was it now, 2 Latin courses and 1 French, or 3 French courses, 3 levels. So by the time you fulfilled your requirements, the opportunity to major was fairly limited. There was almost no social science. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the range of courses. There were a few, but the depth, insofar as there were, was depth, was in the traditional humanities, literature and philosophy, and also, of course, theology, because it was a Jesuit school. Now that, so even within the arts faculty, the tremendous growth of the social sciences has changed that. And if you look at the courses that were available in the literature or whatever, these things have changed dramatically too, as well, in their scope and their nature. Science courses, we had a very modest science program, science and engineering program. So I guess in every way, whether it's the content, the range, the diversity of courses, and the freedom to choose has changed dramatically. Now, that has probably in its own way contributed to the anxiety of students, because there's so much opportunity to choose. If you look at the commerce program now, commerce program, when I was a student, was not much different from an arts program in quite a few. You still had to take 2 Englishes, you had to have so many theologies, and so on. So there were accounting and economics courses, but not the full range of finance, marketing, management, all of those. You know, these are whole new areas that just didn't exist. Not, I mean, here in those years. It's always here. I think a student who had slept for 30 years and woke up and looked at the university today would just wouldn't think he or she was in the same world at all, intellectually.
How have research facilities at St. Mary's changed over time?
Well, I would, if we're going to talk about the arts, I would say at all universities, the, one of the things that has had the a tremendous impact in terms of research has been the computer, and this has transformed, you know, the nature and the types and of research that's done. Even not only in the social sciences, but in what you consider the traditional humanities as well. So one thing that's happened, it seems to me, within the faculty is the greater and the ever-increasing need for enhanced computer resources at the individual faculty level, but also within departments in terms of small dedicated computer labs, which are used not only for teaching but for research. For example, the geography departments have a dedicated lab for computer-assisted graphics, all kinds of courses and individual research. The English department, they have a lab, which is a general student use lab, but it's also an area where they can do, you know, certain types of research. The sociology department has, you know, a tremendous reliance on computers. They don't have their own computer lab, but they have clusters of resources. So that seems to me one area which has changed. When you mentioned resources, did you mean, I'm not sure exactly what you meant besides?
That type of thing, library facilities as well?
Library facilities are never keep pace with the demand. One of our, the library is tremendously better endowed now than when I was a student. We had a very small library. There has been quite literally, not literally, but figuratively, an explosion in knowledge. Part of the problem with keeping up with that is that the cost of journals has skyrocketed. Now, to some extent, this can be offset as more and more becomes available online through computer resources, but it still is. It still is a concern that the library facilities, even with the resources of NovaNet, will not be adequate for certain types of research that's carried on. It's necessary for university professors. It is a real concern, but nevertheless, there has been an attempt to make the most of the resources that we have, either through NovaNet, which you know about, and through electronic, through accessing electronic publications, through things like the ERIC file and these sorts of things. But money is short, and so there is a limitation there. One thing that has been so well supported, I think, at St. Mary's, as within the limits of our resources, has been travel for scholarly purposes, for example, conferences and scholarly research. So computer resources, support through travel, the enhancements in the library, these things were I think are areas that St. Mary's has done a pretty good job in. But then it's demanded an awful lot from the faculty in terms of scholarly productivity. So, you know, you have to support those activities if you're demanding them.
Yes. So, what do you feel that St. Mary's has in particular to offer students?
When I was a student or now?
Both.
Both. If I were going to focus on something that seems to me that has survived over the years that I think is really valuable for students at St. Mary's, that even was part of the culture when I was a student and still exerts an important influence, is that as a culture, as an institution, there is a very strong commitment to providing students with the opportunity for developing themselves completely as a human being. That we don't ever. No, I wouldn't say we don't ever, but there is a recognition that there's more to education than simply providing X numbers of courses for a person and demanding a certain level of achievement in those courses. Academic life is important, but it's not the whole of a person's experience or whole of a person's needs. And more here than many other places that I've been, given our size now and our growth and our diversity, I think we've still held on to a recognition that that we have to address the needs and the concerns of the student as a whole person. Now that's become increasingly challenging as we've brought into St. Mary's an increasingly diverse mix of people. For example, when I was a student here, we had very few physically challenged students, and none that I would know of who had perhaps learning disabilities. Or at least there would be no way of determining that, say, a person had a learning disability and needed a certain amount of support. There were no women students here. But, you know, we had not made any formal commitment to increasing the numbers of, say, Native students or Black students or whatever. And now, although we had a part-time program, the part-time program was certainly not integrated into the regular student stream as it is now. Now we have just a tremendously wide range and variation of students in terms of the population. So it makes the challenge that much more difficult to address them as complete human beings. But it's still something, it seems to me, that we try to do at the faculty level, support staff, administration. There is a kind of esprit de corps. And it, honestly, when you get to be our size, and we're almost at a critical